Dirty Bird Podcast contains foul language and is not appropriate for young fledglings. Listener discretion is advised. Our intro music is brought to you by Ricky Pistone, aka Dick Piston. And our outro music is brought to you by the Sidewalk Slammers. Check them out wherever you get your music.
Are you looking for a podcast today? With ornithology and humor you crave? Well, I know all these guys, and it's birds they like. It's Dirty Bird. Yeah, they're just a couple guys who really like birds. It's Dirty Bird. Yeah, they're pretty dirty, but they really like birds.
Hello, and welcome to Dirty Bird Podcast, a podcast that's serious about birds, but nothing else. In each episode, I tell you about an individual bird species, and today, I'm joined by Tim.
Hey, hey.
Hey, Tim, always great to have you on the show.
Always great to be here, John, and good morning, Dirty Birders. Happy to be back.
Yeah, we're recording in the morning. Tim's recording from Charlotte. We're talking via Zoom. I'm recording from Virginia Beach. There's been some jets flying overhead. They're doing like military practice, so I apologize if there's some of that noise. No Larry today, though.
We'll miss his little whines and playing with his bone.
But today we have a really cool episode. This is a listener-suggested episode. It comes from Seb, who contacted me on Instagram. He really likes the podcast. He had some really nice things to say. He did point out one flaw in the podcast, though. I haven't done any episodes on European birds.
Ah.
Yeah, so he suggested I do an episode on the hoopoe.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a really great suggestion. This bird is super unique. It actually was on the top of my wish list when I was bird watching in England. I never did get to see it, but Seb left me a really cool voicemail about his first experience with the hoopoe. So you want to listen to it, Tim?
Yeah, sure.
All right, let's check it out.
Hello, John, and hello to everyone listening. The first thing I want to say is that I'm a huge fan, and this is probably one of the best podcasts ever. So please keep doing it. Great job. Well, I'm sending this about the hoopoe, or how we call it in Spanish, abobilla. First I have to say that I was, through all my life, very related to nature and the environment in general. I was in the scout movement, I was going hiking, camping, spending a lot of time in the forest, in the mountains and everything. But I really never get into birds. I was always more into big animals or just trees and plants and everything, never into birds until COVID happened. And then when COVID happened, I spent the quarantine with my grandma in her house in the village next to the mountains. I started to notice all these birds that were coming to our backyard, to our garden. And I was giving them, I don't know, seeds and some food. I was like, oh, this is quite interesting. And then I remember the first day after quarantine, I was just going out like crazy, obviously. And I went to the mountains. I saw this bird that it was orange and black and white. And I was like, wait, what is this? And I keep following this bird. It has a weird way of flying and a really strange sound, and I didn't know what it was. And after a few hours I came back home and I did some research, and I was like going to Google, like bird, orange, black and white, weird sound, and I found, and it's called the hoopoe. I don't know how it's correctly pronounced. I hope it's hoopoe, the Eurasian one. And suddenly I was in love. I truly love this bird. And it was the bird that got me into birding. Not that I'm a pro or something. I'm just quite an amateur, and I will say quite a bad one. But I'm still getting there. But I truly love the bird. It was amazing. And for me, this bird represents birding because it was the first thing that caught my eye. And I was like, oh, wow, I need to know more about it. Right. And I'm sure that you're going to make an amazing episode about the bird and you're going to tell a lot of facts and a lot of amazing stories. So I'm going to leave that to you. But I just want to say that this bird is quite incredible. I didn't know it was so popular and that there were so many individuals in Europe and mostly in Spain where I was living at the moment. And after quarantine and after I saw this bird, I spent like the whole summer, if not at least 2 consecutive months, just going to the mountains, just looking for this bird because I was obsessed. I was obsessed with it and I truly love it. I hope everyone else is gonna love it too after your episode. So once again, thank you very much for this opportunity. Your podcast is amazing. I recommend it to everyone. So just grab a beer or a coffee, lay down, relax, and enjoy this amazing podcast. Thank you very much, John. A hug from Poland and see you soon.
That was great.
That was great.
I know. That just warms my heart, picturing Seb at his grandma's going up in the mountains and everything.
Yeah, that's so awesome.
So, Seb mentioned these birds are pretty well known and loved throughout their range. One reason for that is their tiger-like orange and black stripe coloration, complete with an impressive crest. Tim, I think I got a picture of one pulled up for you right now.
Yeah, pretty awesome looking bird.
Yeah, yeah. Do you want to give a quick description?
Sure, yeah. It looks like possibly in like woodpecker sized. Would be the best range I could put on it. Has a nice black and white striped back feathers and fan tail. And the crest is what's really impressive. So it has kind of that, you know, like you said, the light orange color, neck and head, and then the crested feathers on top are, you know, they're very impressive, tall feathers, that look kind of light orange, really pretty color, with black on the top, and then pretty long bill as well. Looks like they are possibly, you know, similar to woodpeckers in their feeding style. I'm not sure, but looks like, you know, that they have the kind of bill that could be used for that.
Yeah, they definitely look, their bill's like slightly down curved. It kind of looks like a northern flicker's bill, which we've talked about on the show before. That crest is super cool. I'll talk about it a little bit more. But a very striking bird. Definitely look up a picture of this if y'all aren't familiar with it, listeners. Yeah, we're going to get in some really, like, that's just the start. It's crest, it's cool colors, that is just scratching the surface with this bird. It has some amazing behaviors.
Yeah.
So there's so much cool stuff about this bird that this is probably going to be a pretty long episode, especially with all the tangents and dumb jokes Tim and I usually get up. But I mean, there's a good reason for that. It's because this bird has been a part of human culture probably since we first evolved, like in Africa, you know. This bird's range includes Africa. And so humans have definitely been noticing this striking bird for a really long time. You know, some cultures have some good things to say about it. There's a lot of nasty things that are said about it, too. And I know I'm making this long episode even longer, but I got to talk about my bird for you just real quick, Tim.
Yeah, do it.
Yeah, you remember last time I was telling you how I was kind of like disappointed in them? There wasn't really much showing up to them. Dude, right. There has just been an explosion in activity with the onset of winter. Yeah,
that's awesome.
Amazing. Like, there's these big flocks of red-winged blackbirds that come, like, 50 at a time. They'll come to the feeder, kind of just clean it out.
Oh, so cool.
Yeah, and then there's actually some flocks of wintering yellow-rumped warblers that have been coming around, too.
Wow, nice. Yeah,
you know, we've got the woodpeckers, you know, red-bellied, downy, hairy. Even a yellow-bellied sapsucker came around.
Oh, cool.
Yep.
Man, that's awesome.
Yeah, and then, you know, just your other common backyard bird feeder, you know, Carolina wrens, white-throated sparrows, goldfinches. Mm-hmm. I have seen some other, I think, like migrating through warblers stop by. I think I saw a prairie warbler. It's really hard to tell when they're in their, you know, winter plumage. But,
yeah.
Man, it's been awesome.
That's great. Yeah, I'm glad to hear it's picked up. It sounds like you got a lot of cool stuff coming by.
Yeah, and with those songbirds coming too, also came some predators. I sent you a picture of that sharp-shinned hawk that was literally just
like he was
sitting.
Yeah, just waiting for a nice little songbird breakfast, maybe.
Yeah, instead he ended up fighting a squirrel.
Yeah, hey, we'll take that too. Defender of the feeders.
Yes, there we go. Yeah. Who needs hot seed or anything when I got a sharp-shinned hawk fighting
exactly.
squirrels? All right, well, let's get on to talking about the hoopoe. So there's actually three species of hoopoe, the most widespread and populous one being the Eurasian hoopoe. The other two are the African hoopoe and the Madagascar hoopoe. There also used to be a separate species of hoopoe that lived on the island of St. Helena, but they became extinct in the 1500s due to invasive species like rats and cats. This hoopoe was actually really cool. It was an example of island giganticism, kind of like our moa, Tim. It was so big it was likely flightless, and you know, just kind of walked around the island eating, and but that also made it really easy prey for cats once they showed up. The bird's common name, hoopoe, is an onomatopoeic name in an attempt to imitate its call.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And, yeah, you heard Seb say, like, its name in Spanish, and pretty much every culture has, like, a different name for it in their language that kind of attempts to imitate its call for the name. Even its genus and species name are onomatopoeic. The genus they belong to is called Upapa. It comes from the Latin word for the bird. And then the Eurasian hoopoe's scientific name is Upapa epops, and the species name epops is also onomatopoeic, and it comes from ancient Greek. The African hoopoe is logically called Upapa africana, and the Madagascar hoopoe is Upapa marginata. The word marginata just means border or margin in Latin, referring how it's just, you know, off on an island by itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that Madagascar hoopoe, logically, it's just confined to Madagascar. The African hoopoe, it extends kind of all over sub-Saharan Africa, especially like South Africa. Both of these species are sedentary and they stay within their range year round. The Eurasian hoopoe, though, is widespread and migratory. They can be found across much of Europe, but kind of avoid really cold Nordic countries for the most part. They're in the southern part of Russia. They're all across Asia. They reach down into India and Malaysia. The southern part of their range, they're kind of there year-round, while the northern populations migrate down to the tropical regions in the winter. And occasionally they'll get blown off course and sometimes end up in Alaska.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that'd be a cool sight.
Yeah.
The reason why they're found over such a wide range is that they're able to adapt to a wide variety of habitats. They basically just need two basic requirements. Bare ground or short grass that allows them to feed on ground-dwelling insects, and vertical cavity-containing features to make their nest in. Because of this, they can be found anywhere from tree-bordered pastures, to open savannas, to even treeless, cliff-filled lands. They're able to flourish within man-made environments too, like farmland, olive groves, and vineyards. They prefer semi-dry climates and aren't found within wetlands, bogs, or deep within the forest. There's one exception to this. The Madagascar hoopoe actually prefers to be deep in the forest, but pretty much all other hoopoes are birds of kind of open pasture land or like arid land. So, as far as, like, the taxonomy of these birds, like, where do they belong, there's been a lot of shuffling around with them. Like, there's some people that even argue that the Madagascar and the African aren't separate species, that they're just subspecies. I don't know. That's split in feathers to me. So I'm just going to say that there's three species. There's also, like, just a lot of debate about evolutionary history with these guys too. So, like, if I get something wrong, people listening, let me know. I did my best. I'll go later on in the show, I'll go into more in-depth explanation about their evolution and stuff and talk about their subspecies. But the most recent research that I found placed them in the order Buchaeratiformes, along with hornbills like Zazu from Lion King. That order name, Buchaeratiformes, it actually comes from the Greek word bucheros, which refers to the horns of cattle. So we already kind of described the hoopoe. Tim did a great job describing it to us. It's about the size of a blue jay, and of course the first thing you see is that awesome crest. What's really cool about this crest is it's not like a mohawk crest, you know, like you see on a cardinal. When they're just kind of perched, chilling, it does look like a blue jay or cardinal crest. But when they display it and fan it out, it's like, you know, like a crown on a king, the way that it fans out. Or looks like, you know, one of the fans that, like, in old movies you see Southern gentlemen's, like, waving themselves with, oh my lord. gives it kind of a fierce appearance and larger than life appearance too, when it's got that thing furled out. And then it's got that long, slender, down curved bill. Its body is mostly orange, but then it's got those zebra like black and white striped wings and tail. The male and female look pretty similar. The male's just a little bit more brightly colored and slightly larger. So a little bit about their behavior. Tim, you mentioned that they look a lot like woodpeckers, and you know, they have a lot of similarities too. Their flight pattern is actually similar to that of the woodpeckers we have here in North America. They have short, broad, round wings. So they don't do any kind of gliding. The way that they fly is like similar to how you see woodpeckers do with that undulating flight pattern, where they're kind of like going in a wavy line. They'll flap, 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 and then stop and dip down, and then flap, flap, flap again, and then dip down. It's been described that they resemble a giant butterfly when they fly.
Huh, that's cool.
Yeah, so, like, very characteristic flight. I mean, woodpeckers, it's always super easy to tell them just from their flight pattern, so that's another way with this bird, too. As I mentioned earlier, hoopoes prefer a warm and dry climate that supports open, bare ground or grassland areas that they need to forage for ground-dwelling bugs in. Because of this, there's not a lot of standing water for them to take bird baths in. So instead, they exclusively take dust baths. They'll actually excavate a little shallow depression in the ground, and then they lay in it and heap dust over their bodies to cleanse their feathers from both parasites and excess oil buildup.
Nice. I recently switched to the same thing, actually.
Oh, yeah? You got a dust shower now? Yep. You turn on the faucet and it's just dust pouring in.
Exclusively.
I'm sure Julia would love that. Cooper would probably like it.
Oh, yeah.
They can also be observed sunbathing on the ground. They do a pretty funny posture. They will lie flat on the ground, spread out their wings and tail, and then point their bill straight up at the sky. So they're just soaking up the rays.
Yeah.
And it not only bathes on the ground, but it also feeds on the ground. We've seen that down-curved bill before in a couple birds, Tim. Our northern flicker has a down-curved bill. Yep. And then the Carolina wren, too.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Yeah. This helps them to more efficiently probe the ground in search of bugs. Usually see hoopoes on the ground taking short shuffling steps. They are strong walkers though, and will run when they need to. Their feet and bill get pretty dirty from this feeding strategy. So whenever you see them perched on a tree or rock, they're often observed cleaning their feet, bills, and feathers. And they're pretty solitary birds. Usually you see them feeding alone, sometimes in pairs during the breeding season. You rarely see flocks of them, usually during migration or the winter months, and only up to 25 individuals at a time. So they're pretty characteristic with their call. It's pretty much unmistakable. And yeah, like a Pokemon, they say their own name. their call can be confused with cuckoo calls. It does sound kind of similar, especially the African cuckoo sounds a lot like it. But there's some subtle differences. That hoopoo call is given by the male as an advertisement call, basically, to both attract a mate and to claim its territory. How long the hoopoos are able to hold each note may be a determining factor in successfully attracting a mate. I read a study that was conducted in the olive groves of Granada in southern Spain, and they found that synthetically engineered hoopoo songs with longer phrases attracted more females than those with short phrases.
Wow.
So kind of to explain that, like for those that are musically inclined, it's kind of like they went from a half note to a whole note in the song. Mm-hmm. Basically, like they held out the notes of their calls a little longer. I kind of imagine these birds like opera singers doing a cadenza. Whoever can hold out the longest note just attracts all the ladies. They're just like, hoo-poo, calling the ladies to them. The calling starts several weeks prior to egg laying and is given from an elevated perch on the ground or during flight. The male can be observed often pointing his bill downward prior to calling in order to inflate his airway to produce the loudest call possible. And this kind of reminds me of the American Bittern. When I did the episode on that guy, it kind of like, you know, would burp out its song, basically, like inflate its esophagus. The hoopoe also appears to do that. It inflates and bulges out its throat right before it gives a call. The Madagascar hoopoe actually has a pretty different call from the Eurasian and African hoopoe.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so you can hear that one's much more of like a rolling, trilling call. It actually kind of reminds me of the Eastern screech owl call back here in the U.S.
Yeah, I can see that.
But the Eurasian and the African hoopoe both have the same song. And so that's why there's some debate whether they're just like same species and subspecies of each other.
Mm-hmm.
Hoopoe do more than just say their name, though. They also give some other vocalizations, such as a long caw and short caw. And then they also make a lot of sounds during disputes with other hoopoes and during courtship. They also do a rattle call that conveys excitement. And the nestlings give a high-pitched begging call. So that's their vocalizations. Before I launch into talking about their feeding and their breeding, I'm going to take a couple minutes and talk about two of the most interesting things about this bird species. They have a literal superpower. I swear this bird is a fucking Pokemon. and that's part of the reason why it's captured the attention of humans over a millennium. So first off, let's talk about what a wonder of evolution this bird is. It kind of reminds me of a story about the platypus that I once heard, that when specimens were first brought to Europe by scientists from Australia, the European scientists thought that someone was playing a trick on them by just sewing together different animal parts. And I mean, that's what the hoopoe is kind of like. It's got a beak like a ground feeding woodpecker, a crest reminiscent of like a fighting rooster, the coloration of a tiger, and the defense mechanisms of a skunk.
Yeah.
Yep, that's right. These birds have specially developed glands that allow them to spray foul-smelling liquid at potential predators.
Wow.
Yeah. This adaptation is specific to just the nestlings and the brooding mothers. The birds have specially adapted uropygial glands. We've talked about uropygial glands many times on this show. A lot of birds have them. They produce oil that they use to coat and protect their feathers. It's also used to add color to feathers during the mating season. I just talked about it on my last episode on brown pelicans. They use it to turn their head and feathers a rich yellow color during the breeding season. The hoopoes use their uropygial gland for all these functions too, but it also takes on another interesting twist. During the breeding season, the uropygial gland of mothers and their nestlings changes. It becomes larger, darker, and stinkier. The nestlings' glands develop really quickly. They reach a maximum size at about 12 days old. But as early as day 6, they're able to start squirting nest intruders with a mixture of feces, urine, and foul-smelling oil in a jet stream that can reach as far as 2 feet.
Wow. Pretty good defense.
Yeah, I know. Like, you try to, there's lots of videos of like snakes or like, you know, other predators trying to come to the nest hole, and the nestlings just immediately like turn around, show their butts, and spray them right in the face. And as if this bird wasn't enough, animals mash together at once. When they're threatened, the nestlings will also adopt a terrifying defense posture where they raise their crest, jab with their bill, and hiss like a snake.
Wow.
Yeah, so they're like a woodpecker, chicken, snake, skunk, tiger hybrid. What gives the uropygial gland its stink is really interesting. It's a rich microbiome of symbiotic bacteria that grow and live inside it. PCR analysis has found 68 different genuses of bacteria within breeding hoopoe uropygial glands. The genus Clostridia makes up a large percentage of the bacteria. Clostridia, like, we encounter them in the hospital all the time. Like, if you've ever heard of C. diff, that's like kind of a bad bacteria. But it's kind of found naturally in the colon and stuff. The reason why Clostridia are so important to the hoopoe uropygial gland is because they produce a substance called butanoic acid, which is a foul-smelling chemical. It's sometimes used for synthetic fishing bait or stink bombs. So if you've ever used like that synthetic like catfish bait, Tim, that smells really stinky, it probably had butanoic acid in it. Huh. And the hoopoe have Clostridia bacteria that produce it to give them their skunk-like superpower.
Yeah.
And the cool thing is, you know, this skunk spray is not just a defense mechanism. The microbiome not only produces the defensive stink, but it also acts like natural antibiotics. Hmm. While incubating, mother hoopoes will coat their eggs with oil from their uropygial gland. They will collect droplets of the oil from the gland onto her bill, and then smear the eggs directly. She'll also coat her brood patch. That's like an area of bare skin, usually on mother birds, that allows them to transfer heat directly to the eggs. And of course, if she coats it with oil, it'll also coat the eggs with oil. This coating eggs in oil is actually not specific to the hoopoe. A lot of birds do it. It's part of what gives bird eggs their distinctive and beautiful colors. When a hoopoe mother first lays her eggs, they are blue-gray, but then as she coats them with the oil, they darken to a greenish-brown color. And it's more than just cosmetic. Like I said, it acts like a natural antibiotic. When the oil is excreted onto the eggshells, The harmless hoopoe bacteria help suppress any disease-causing bacteria. Studies have shown that secretions from hoopoe uropygial glands have antimicrobial activity against Bacillus lichenformis, which is a bacteria found in the feathers of many ground-dwelling birds and potentially cause disease. It's even known actually to cause sepsis in immunocompromised humans. So is a bad bug.
Yeah.
Bacillus lichenformis is also a major bacteria that causes feather degradation in birds. So when adult hoopoes smear their own uropygial secretions on their feathers, it may help protect them against this bacteria also. One of the antimicrobial bacteria isolated from hoopoe uropygial glands is Enterococcus faecalis. I was really surprised when I read this because I encounter Enterococcus faecalis a lot in the hospital. Hmm. It's part of your natural gut biome, hence why it's called faecalis, like fecal. Mm-hmm. But if it gets out of the gut, like especially like into, you know, urine infections or something, it can cause some pretty nasty infections, and it has a lot of antibiotic resistance. Hmm. But strains of Enterococcus faecalis isolated from hoopoe produce a chemical that inhibits a wide range of other harmful bacterias. This chemical is termed Enterocin MRR10-3, and it has antibacterial properties against bad bacteria like Staph aureus, the bug that causes MRSA, E. coli, Listeria, and Bacillus lichenformis, that feather-degrading bacteria we just talked about.
Hmm. Wow.
But wait, there's more. Not only do they deter predators and inhibit bacteria, but the uropygial gland secretions might also act like insect repellent.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Quite the gland.
Yeah, I know. It's one gland with many functions. One study in Spain found that mosquitoes, biting midges, and black flies were caught in lower numbers in traps that contained hoopoe uropygial gland secretions, suggesting that they might be acting like insect repellent to these blood-sucking bugs. The way that the hoopoe get their bacteria is through vertical transmission, so from the mother to the nestlings when she smears the eggs with oil or while she like broods them when they're fledglings, and also via horizontal transmission from the environment, especially within that nesting cavity, because they'll use their nesting cavity for many years by many different hoopoe families. So, you know, as their shit and feathers and debris collect inside of the nesting cavity, it also harbors the bacteria. And so, you know, they get a rich microbiome of bacteria from that.
Mm-hmm.
Different populations of hoopoe actually have their own signature gut microbiomes. There's also some anecdotal evidence that the stinky oil on the eggs may help reduce predation. Like, no one wants their scrambled eggs to taste like rotten meat. But I never saw any studies that actually prove that.
Hmm.
All right, let's talk a bit about how these birds have interacted with humans over thousands of years. The foul smell of the hoopoes really seems to be something that different cultures have latched onto, especially Western societies. It seems pretty widespread that people thought the birds smelled like shit because they eat shit. Pliny the Elder, in his Naturalis Historia, wrote that the hoopoe is a foul-feeding bird. German and Scandinavian folklore also associate this bird with shit, uncleanliness, and as an obscene sex symbol. I found a suggestion that it's like a phallic symbol because something about the ancient German name for hoopoe also sounds like the ancient German word for penis. But puns in dead languages are definitely beyond the scope of this podcast. Isidore of Seville in the 7th century wrote, "The hoopoe inspects and feeds on human excrement. It is a disgusting bird."
Harsh.
Yeah, I know. And apparently stink like a hoopoe is still a derogatory phrase in Central Europe.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Not everyone focuses on its stink, though. There are some more flattering cultural depictions of the hoopoe. Hoopoe feature in the artwork and hieroglyphics of ancient Egyptian tombs. The tomb of Khnumhotep II, who reigned over parts of Upper Egypt around 2000 BC, features artwork of him hunting and trapping birds with spears, throw sticks, and nets. One bird is unmistakable, an orange-crested bird with a down-curved bill sitting in an acacia tree. The hoopoe, along with a few other bird species in the tree, like shrikes and redstart, are noticeably not being enclosed by the net that's snaring the other birds right next to them. This demonstrates the hoopoe's significance to the Egyptians, not as a potential food source, but rather as a spiritual symbol of rebirth. Hoopoes are resident to Egypt, but their populations increase in the winter when northern populations migrate into Egypt. Egyptians saw migratory birds as returning souls of the dead, and they're molting in spring to their spring plumage is a symbol of rebirth. Children are also sometimes pictured in Egyptian art holding hoopoes. I've read that the reasoning behind this is that hoopoe are cooperative breeders. That's like what the deciphering of the hieroglyphics said. I've talked about cooperative breeding on the show before. Our brown-headed nuthatches do it. It means that individuals that are not directly the father or mother help to raise nestlings, usually like children from previous broods that haven't started breeding on their own yet. So when children are holding hoopoes in Egyptian artwork, it supposedly symbolizes how a pharaoh's children care for their elders and also take care of the people of Egypt, which are the pharaoh's metaphorical children. The problem is that I don't, like, beyond a couple references that I see that, like, don't seem to really hold up, hoopoes don't cooperatively breed. I did find evidence that their close relatives, the greenwood hoopoes, do cooperatively breed. So, I don't know, maybe there's some kind of mix-up going on with these birds, or it's just like a very ancient old wives' tale.
Yeah, could be.
But it seems to be pretty pervasive throughout time and cultures. Persian poets praised the hoopoe's devotion to family. And in some Middle Age bestiaries, which are like the medieval version of an animal encyclopedia, they record that as hoopoes age, their children pull out old feathers and lick the mist from their old clouded eyes. The ancient Greeks even had a saying, helpful as a hoopoe, which also seems to allude to its cooperative nature.
Yeah.
The Greeks really had a lot to say about hoopoes. They actually feature in the story of the rightfully vengeful sisters, Procne and Philomela. I actually tell that story in my osprey episode because the osprey's genus name, Pandion, comes from their father. I'm not going to tell that story here. Listen to my osprey episode and you'll figure out how the hoopoe features in it. That story actually leads into a play called Ornithes, written in 400 BC by the famous Greek playwright Aristophanes. The hoopoe's a main character and kind of the leader of the birds in that play. There's way too much Greek hoopoe stuff for me to mention in this episode. Even Zeus transforms into a hoopoe at one point during his lusty adventures. but across a wide range of cultures, the hoopoe is also associated with medicinal qualities. Greco-Romans used various parts of its body for everything from aphrodisiacs to truth serums. The ancient Arabs referred to it as the doctor bird, due to its medicinal qualities. And in the Middle East, the hoopoe was pretty much venerated overall. The Persian poet Attar of Nishapur, in his epic The Conference of Birds, written in 1177, wrote that the hoopoe was the wisest of all birds. Afghan folklore also tends to compare the birds to the local religious leaders called mullah. This seems to be in part complimentary, but also a joke. The hoopoe looks grand with its crest and struts around looking prideful. So it's kind of a joke on the mullah being like, you know, all grand in town, strutting around the way the hoopoe does.
Mm-hmm.
The hoopoe also features in the Quran, too, where it helps to introduce the prophet Solomon to the beautiful Queen Sheba. And it features throughout the Quran a lot, like with Solomon. The prophet Muhammad was also said to forbid the eating of the hoopoe. The hoopoe features in Jewish tradition also. It first pops up in the book of Leviticus, where God tells Moses which birds the Jewish people can and can't eat. The hoopoe is included among birds that can't be eaten, alongside ostriches, ospreys, and bats. which I guess are birds, according to the Old Testament.
I guess so.
This is the hoopoe's only feature in the Bible, as far as I could tell. But Jewish folklore also has some stories about the hoopoe, similar to those laid out in the Quran. It tells a positive story about the bird and its various roles helping out King Solomon. Because of this, the hoopoe was actually named the National Bird of Israel in 2008.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool.
There's literally books and books about how humans have thought and interacted with hoopoes over thousands of years, so I'm just scratching the surface here.
Yeah.
But those are kind of some of the most interesting facts that I found.
Yeah.
So let's launch into some feeding and breeding with these birds.
Sounds good.
So, like I said, they have that down-curved bill, just like the Carolina wren and the northern flickers. This makes them a ground-feeding specialist. They, just like the Carolina wren and the northern flicker, mainly eat insects. They pick live insects off the ground, but mostly they'll probe the ground with their bills to find subterranean grubs, larvae, and ground-dwelling insects like mole crickets. What they'll do is they'll insert their bill to various levels in the dirt, open and close it to excavate or chase bugs down into their burrows. They must have a pretty sensitive bill tip to be able to do this. Because unlike the northern flicker, who has a similarly shaped bill to the hoopoe, the northern flicker uses its tongue to capture, you know, mostly ants that it feeds on. The hoopoe, though, really just uses its bill to capture prey. Its tongue still helps a little bit, but the tongue only takes up about 2/3 of the bill length. It is covered with backwards-facing, spear-shaped papilla, which kind of latch onto prey items once it gets them on its tongue and prevents them from escaping back out the bill. Instead, these papilla help direct the prey back towards the back of the tongue, which is crammed full of large lingual glands that help lubricate the prey items and mucus so that they slide down the esophagus. These birds don't usually sweat the small stuff when they're feeding. They go for the biggest bugs. They'll only eat small prey like fly larvae or ants if nothing else is available. The same seems to be the case with earthworms. They don't seem to factor much into the hoopoe diet. Which I thought was kind of weird. You'd think like a bird that, you know, feeds on the ground, like probably, and digs into the ground would probably eat a lot of earthworms.
Yeah.
Yeah, but this might just be because where they feed, there's not much earthworms. They're usually in pretty dry environments. Mm-hmm. And, you know, earthworms like moist soil and, you know, hoopoe don't really like a wet environment.
Right. Got to have the dust baths available.
Yeah, they got to have their dust baths. No water showers, just straight dust shower. Their big bug prey often needs to be hammered in submission before they eat it. So sometimes hoopoes will have like a favorite rock or perch that they will return to over and over again to beat their prey before eating it. That's kind of similar, I think, in our bittern episode. I think also in the great blue heron episode, we kind of talked about how when they catch something, when they catch fish, they'll beat them to get the spines off.
Mm-hmm.
These guys do the same thing. They beat the bugs to remove the indigestible legs, antenna, and wings. They are also known to catch lizards and frogs, too.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. In addition to hammering those lizards or frogs to, you know, kill them before they eat them, they will also stab them in the head with their bills. I did find an account where a hoopoe killed a pretty large toad. It doesn't seem like it was for food. Maybe it was due to some kind of territorial dispute. So these hoopoe do have a little bit of a mean streak.
Yeah.
They will flip over rocks and sticks when they search for food. Sometimes they're seen on trees, flicking bits of bark off, similar to a woodpecker. They're also known to probe into animal dung in search of food. And I think this is probably the source of that old wives' tale about them eating shit. Is,
yeah.
You know, some person 3,000 years ago saw a hoopoe probing into some animal dung in search of bugs, and it's like, hey, that bird smells like shit. It's eating shit.
Yeah.
Logic. Rainy periods are actually bad for hoopoe feeding, and droughts help them out. Although if it does rain, they aren't completely fucked. Hoopoos are pretty good at taking advantage of whatever bug prey is abundant. Mm-hmm. If it's not ground-dwelling beetles and crickets that they're able to find, they will dig up earthworms and eat them. They'll sometimes even snatch flies out of the air. Mm. It has other physical adaptations beyond just the down-curved bill that help make it a fearsome bug predator. Its skull, while proportionally small for its body, contains air pockets called pneumatization. A lot of birds have pneumatization of their bones. It helps them be lighter in flight. It also functions in their respiratory system. Check out the pelican episode and my bird bods episode. I talk about that. In the hoopoe skull, these air pockets are concentrated around the temporal bones, where the bird's hearing apparatus is. It's been hypothesized that this helps amplify sounds like a trumpet, helping the hoopoe hear bugs crawl under leaves or burrowing underground.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I know. They have like these specially adapted skulls for listening in on bugs, yeah, as they burrow underground and then stabbing, mm-hmm, its bill in and grabbing them.
Yeah.
They have really strong ligaments that surround the mandibular joints, where the hoopoe's beak connects to its skull. This prevents the beak from dislocating as it hammers into the hard ground or bashes its prey to pieces. This is especially important because hoopoes often probe the ground with the beak held slightly open. These ligaments are further reinforced by being partially ossified, meaning they're kind of half muscle and half bone. One last note on hoopoe feeding, since they eat a lot of ground-dwelling larvae and bugs, and really any juicy bug that they see crawling on the ground, they are really important for keeping beetles and caterpillars in check. I read a study that showed that forests without hoopoes are more prone to becoming severely defoliated by caterpillars. Mm-hmm. And there's also some anecdotal evidence that they eat pests that would otherwise destroy farmers' crops, too.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I mean they're a stinky bird, but well loved too.
Yeah.
So let's talk about their breeding. Just a quick note, since these birds cover such a wide range that spans both the northern and southern hemispheres, I'm not even going to try to go into like dates that the breeding usually occurs. It varies widely by region. But in general, they are non-breeding during the winter months in whatever hemisphere they're in. And don't think about breeding until the spring or summer. The breeding cycle of hoopoes also varies a bit based on whether they're sedentary or migratory. In migratory populations, males arrive to the breeding grounds first, before the females, and immediately begin singing and establishing their territory. Sedentary populations of hoopoes tend to clump together a bit during the winter months, but as breeding season approaches, they get restless and the flocks gradually break up as individuals establish territory. As the male sings, he attracts females to him and also tells any nearby males to buzz off or be prepared to fight. These birds have been recorded engaging in some pretty intense combat. Males do most of the fighting, either running after each other on the ground or chasing each other in the air. But females will also engage in combat with each other. The fighting between males has been compared to that of two fighting gamecocks. The birds will leap wildly into the air, flap their wings, their crests held erect and tall, and just going at each other with beak and claw. Mm. The whole male territory centers around a suitable nesting cavity. That's really like the rate limiting factor for these birds, is having a suitable nesting cavity. Mm-hmm. The hoopoes don't excavate their own nests the way that woodpeckers do. They have to look for a pre-existing cavity in trees or rocks. Sometimes they use man-made structures like bird boxes or some stranger areas like termite mounds or even within clumps of moss or orchids that grow in the treetops. Males will locate suitable nesting sites and clear them of any debris, but they won't really add much material to them. Sometimes hoopoe nests have been found with thin layers of grass, leaves, or feathers on the bottom. They seem to prefer nesting in holes that have been used previously by other hoopoe, especially when those hoopoe have left some material behind. This is because, like I talked about, they get a horizontal transmission of some of their symbiotic bacteria. So mm-hmm. if you show up to a hoopoe nest and there's some old nesting material, I mean, that's free bacteria for you.
Yeah, yeah. Might as well take it.
Yeah, seriously. Studies have shown that when a hoopoe mother uses a nesting cavity filled with eggshells, old feathers, or other nesting debris from previous occupants, she has a more diverse microbiome in her uropygial gland. The male uses the nesting hole also to court the female. He doesn't just sing to attract her, he'll also walk in and out of the nesting cavity, sort of proving to the female that he's got a nice house to raise babies in. If the female likes what she sees, the birds will undergo a sort of honeymoon phase for the next 2 weeks. They will engage in courtship feeding, where the male will approach the female with a food item, like a big juicy caterpillar, and utter a special feeding call. After the female takes the food item, it's baby-making time, and the male will make cloacal contact with her for around 5 seconds. I can't help but make a little human comparison here. I wonder if the male is basically like taking the female out to dinner, you know, hoping he'll get laid.
Yeah.
I wonder if he's more successful in mating, you know, depending on how good the food item is. Like, if he brings her a big old mole cricket, you know, that's like hoopoe lobster. And she's like,
as long as it's not dung, then he's in the clear.
Yeah. If he brings dung, she's like, nah, not tonight, pal.
Yeah.
They're mostly monogamous during the breeding season. There's no evidence to suggest, though, that like they'll meet up again in other breeding seasons. Like they usually tend to switch partners, from what I could tell. But they will be mostly monogamous during a breeding season. They are capable in some areas of their range in raising 2 broods in 1 brooding season. But often they don't even stick together for that second brood. You know, like they'll find entirely different mates to form the second brood with. There is some extra pair paternity, you know, sneaking off on the side. One study in Granada, Spain, found about 7% of chicks were the result of the female copulating with, you know, a male other than her mate. And remember earlier how I talked about how females seem to really like males that can hold out a long note, those opera singing hoopoes?
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, hoopoe males that have long note lengths in their songs never have any extra pair paternity in their nests. Yeah, so either this like long note holding scared away any rival males, or it just really bonded the female to him.
Yeah.
She's like, he's a good singer. I don't even need anything on the side.
Yep.
After about 2 weeks of copulation and honeymooning, the female would begin to lay her eggs, and now the real work begins. How many eggs she lays varies a lot by location. In the tropics, clutch size is fairly low, only about 4 to 7 eggs, while in Northern Europe, it can be as many as 12. The female exclusively incubates the eggs, while the male just focuses on finding and bringing food to her. And remember, while the female is incubating these eggs, she's also coating them in that magical, stinky uropygial gland oil. As she does this, the eggs go from light blue to dark brown. The male is paying close attention, too, to this egg color change, and he'll actually base how much effort he puts into gathering food based on how much color change there is. If the eggs stay pretty bright, that means they're not getting coated in a lot of oil, and he will bring less food because there's a high chance that the eggs or the young will get sick and die. However, if they're nice and dark, he will really hustle and invest a lot of effort into bringing food to the nest. After about 15 to 18 days, the first eggs begin to hatch. The eggs hatch asynchronously, with each egg hatching about 24 hours apart. This does mean that you're going to get some chicks that hatch later and are smaller and unable to compete with the bigger siblings for food.
Mm-hmm.
Usually one nestling in each brood ends up starving. The young are born with fluffy, downy feathers that cover their bodies. Just a quick digression here. I told you we were going to go on some tangents, Tim.
Yeah.
When I was like researching this about the hoopoes, and I saw that they, you know, are born with downy feathers. I also discovered a new interesting word. I read hoopoe young are not gymnopaedic. This sent me down this rabbit hole where I Googled gymnopaedic. And all that really popped up was a Spartan festival where young men would dance naked together. I hope Lauren isn't looking at my internet search history. But in birds, apparently, gymnopaedic refers to young that are born naked and without feathers. I don't know how I'm just learning about this word, because most of the birds that I've talked about in this show are born that way.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's different to hear one that's, you know, born with downy feathers, because I feel like most of them are, you know, I'm used to hearing that they're born, you know, naked and featherless. So.
Yeah, and the word I always see is altricile, referring to when they're born, you know, naked and blind and totally dependent on their parents. Mm-hmm. But I kind of like that gymnopaedic term. Like, it makes me think that the birds are just having a fun time dancing around the nest naked.
Yeah.
Anyways, these non-gymnopaedic birds, they're not naked and they're not dancing. After about 5 days of life, their downy feathers are replaced by spiny, quill-like feather sheaths that give them a hedgehog-like appearance. We've seen this with a lot of other nesting bird species. Later on, these feather sheaths will unfurl and give them their juvenile plumage. The young are still unable to thermoregulate with just these spiny quills, though, and fluffy down feathers, so they require incubation by their mother. Until their juvenile plumage develops, it's up to dad to deliver them all the food while mom stays on the nest with them. Feeding of the birds within this dark nesting cavity is facilitated by white-colored skin that lines the outside of their mouths. So when the nestlings gape, it's basically like a white circle to help mom and dad guide food into their mouths. By day 14, their quills have unfurled, and they have developed their distinctive hoopoe crest. They're also pretty active and start moving around the nest around this time. And since their quills are unfurled, this allows mom to leave the nest and start bringing food also. As they get even older, they begin to clump around the entrance to the nest hole in anticipation of their parents bringing them food. Both the male and female now will bring food to the young. I saw one paper talking about the African hoopoe nesting. It said that while females will bring food straight into the nesting cavity to the young, the male really never enters the nest. He either passes food to the female or he gives it to the young when they're old enough to walk up to the entrance. I don't really blame dad for not wanting to enter into the hoopoe hole. From everything I've read, that nesting cavity is pretty disgusting.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the mom's spraying her oil gland all over the place, and then there's just baby bird poop. Like, that sounds disgusting.
Right.
Here, take your food. I'm not coming in.
Yeah.
After about 25 to 30 days, the baby birds are fully fledged and ready to leave the nest. Depending on if the parents have a second brood or not, fledgling birds may hang out with their parents for several weeks to months after leaving the nest. And hoopoe will perform a post-breeding molt, starting with their head and crest feathers first. If they're a migratory population, they will pause their molt until after they migrate to their wintering grounds so that they can still fly and make their migration. This is usually just the adult birds that do this. Juveniles usually wait until they migrate to the migratory grounds in order to exchange their drab female-like plumages for their adult plumage, although they sometimes get started early replacing the feathers on their head and crest prior to migration, similar to adults. While birds are able to breed at 1 year of age, they usually don't start breeding until 2 years old. So, that's a lot about hoopoe feeding, breeding, their stink superpowers. Any thoughts here, Tim?
It's awesome to hear about, you know, such a unique bird, and there's just so many, you know, different qualities and its, you know, significance to so many different cultures. So, yeah, it was a great suggestion for an episode.
Yeah, I really want to go to Europe now and do like a birding trip and see these guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
Euro trip. So I'll talk a bit about their population, some, you know, predators, diseases, threats to these guys, and wrap up with evolutionary history like I always do. It's estimated that the worldwide population is around 5 to 10 million wild hoopoes. They're listed as a species of least concern, but because they're so widespread, different local populations encounter different difficulties. For example, the hoopoe population on the Canary Islands is at risk for extinction. There's also some evidence that the Eurasian hoopoe population is declining overall. There's been some conservation efforts in the northern part of the range where they are especially scarce. Countries such as Switzerland and Germany. It appears that installing nest boxes has helped preserve populations there and also attract new immigrants. There's also some evidence that global warming may be helping these birds expand their range north. They only live for about 10 years in the wild at their oldest. So, I mean, they're not a very long-lived bird. They're kind of, you know, around the average songbird lifespan.
Mm-hmm.
As far as predators for these guys, they really don't have many predators. I saw references that its oil-covered feathers gave it a foul taste, but never really found any firsthand accounts of that. I almost wish that John James Audubon had made like a Euro trip and studied these birds. Because, I mean, that guy shot and ate every bird he came across.
Oh, yeah.
Really, their main, like, you know, the nestlings and the mother, you know, when they're on the nest, they'll spray the skunk gland. But, you know, that gland goes away in the non-breeding season. So really, when a predator approaches these birds, their main defense is just to freeze. If they're in a bush or on a tree trunk, their seemingly bold striped patterns actually provide pretty good camouflage.
Hmm.
And even though the mothers and the nestlings do have that stinky superpower, they still suffer pretty high levels of predation when they're in their nesting holes. This is because their nesting holes are usually located under 30 feet high, so it makes them accessible to a wide range of predators such as small mammals, lizards, and snakes.
Right.
And I even saw some like anecdotal evidence that, you know, their stinky smell, that some species of like animals may even use that to help find the holes. So it's kind of a good defense mechanism, but also like a red flag that, hey, there's a hoopoe here.
Yeah. I guess if someone's hungry enough, they can say, you know, I'm going to fight through the smell and make my way to that nesting cavity.
Yep. Even if predators don't get them, there's usually always one hoopoe chick that dies in the nest. Since they hatch asynchronously like that, there's always going to be one big chick and one runt in the litter. Studies have shown that the mother preferentially feeds the biggest chicks first and only feeds the runts once the big chicks are full. So the big get bigger and the small get smaller.
Mm-hmm.
I did see that African hoopoe are sometimes attacked by drongo and fiscal shrike, who they compete with for food. I saw that Elanora's falcon and sooty falcons prey on hoopoe during their migration, especially when they migrate over bodies of water. They'll just kind of grab them out of the sky. There's also invasive species that compete for nesting cavities with these birds. I found a study from Israel that showed that the invasive ring-necked parakeet had a negative impact on hoopoe population density.
Hmm.
Parakeets are pretty smart birds, and they're pretty aggressive and will mob up on hoopoes and monopolize all of the nesting cavities.
Wow.
One major factor in ring-necked parakeet success seems to be the introduction of non-native plants to Israel, specifically the date palm, which is popular in gardens and orchards.
Mm.
Ring-necked parakeet populations in Israel seem to be paired with the date palms. So if there's no date palms, there's no ring-necked parakeets, and the hoopoes are able to do well. But
mm-hmm.
you bring in those date palms, the ring-necked parakeets come with it and just out-compete the hoopoes.
Yeah.
So this is another reason to grow native plants.
Yep, absolutely.
There's also a type of feather louse called Upupacola upupe. Upupacola sounds like a terrible version of a Coca-Cola.
Hey,
hey, Upupacola. tastes like shit. Anyway, this feather louse is found only in the crest feathers of the hoopoe. So that's a very specific environment to live in.
It is, yeah.
All right, Tim, let's wrap up with evolution.
All right.
All right, so I couldn't find a lot specifically on hoopoe evolution, but a lot of research has gone into the evolution and genomes of their close relative, the hornbill. So this section will be kind of less robust than some of my other evolution sections because I'm kind of pulling from hornbill evolution and extrapolating. But the hoopoes do share an evolutionary history with another group of birds we've talked about on the show before, the kingfishers.
Ah, hey.
Yeah. They're part of the clade Coracoformis, which first emerged around 66 to 60 million years ago, somewhere in the Palearctic region, which is composed of Eurasia, North Africa, and the Mediterranean. They're part of a subclade of Coracoformis called Bucerotiformis, as I mentioned earlier. Which split off from the Coracoformis. It's unclear exactly where this common ancestor first split off. Buchaerotiformes contains hoopoes, hornbills, wood hoopoes, and scimitar bills. These are all birds native to Africa and Asia. The first major split in this clade came with the hornbills, who split off from the ancestor that would later go on to form the hoopoes, wood hoopoes, and scimitar bills around 55 million years ago. It's unclear exactly where Buchaerotiformes was developing at. From what I read, it seems that the clade may have first formed in Africa because it appears that's where the hornbill split happened. But development of the hoopoe and its friends appeared to have occurred in Asia. The ancestral hoopoes seem to have already been pretty widespread, though. The earliest fossil record of hoopoe ancestors comes from the extinct genus Mesella risor, which is named for the Messel region of Germany, where its fossils have been found. These fossils show a bird with a long, down-curved beak similar to the hoopoe and date from around 49 million years ago. Fossils for other Mesella risor have been found across Europe, also in England and France. Looking at the feet of these fossils suggests that they fed mainly by clinging onto tree trunks, similar to the way wood hoopoes do today, but not similar to hoopoes, which, you know, feed on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Our hoopoe's feet are specially adapted to feeding on the ground. One Zoom Tree of Life suggests that the hoopoe genus formed around 35 million years ago. However, we really don't have many fossils of the hoopoe. The earliest ones come from those giant, flightless St. Helena hoopoe.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. And they first pop up in the fossil record within the past 2 million years.
Hmm.
So it's kind of a black box exactly what happened with right. hoopoe evolution. The common hoopoe-like ancestor that fed by clinging to trees continued to diversify and develop new species even after the ground-feeding hoopoe split off. The scimitar bills formed from this ancestor a few million years after the hoopoe. Scimitar bills, you know, they have a down-curved bill that looks like a scimitar sword, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then the wood hoopoes formed within the past 20 million years, and they're still undergoing a lot of diversification. The newest member, the violet wood hoopoe, formed around 2 million years ago. And just looking at wood hoopoes and scimitar bills, it's pretty obvious that hoopoes are related to them. They all have down-curved bills. Wood hoopoes especially look similar. They have short, round wings. They also appear to share the same structure of bone in their middle ear called the stapes. Apparently, they have a more ancient reptilian appearance, stapes, compared to other birds. And a final ending note on the hoopoe and their subspecies. Hoopoe have not always been so widespread. In the past 2 million years, especially as ice ages came and went, hoopoes likely underwent cyclic expansions when the climate was warm and retreat when the glaciers advanced. Studies of their mitochondrial DNA show that hoopoe underwent significant bottlenecking in the last few hundred thousand years, meaning that the population was severely reduced and restricted to one area. This was likely during a major glaciation event. As the glaciers retreated again, the few hoopoe that began journeying out to establish in lands left, by glaciers retreating, they left a big genetic footprint. This is called the founder effect.
Hmm.
This is especially evident in the northern European countries like Switzerland or Austria, where the hoopoe has more recently colonized. There are 9 currently recognized subspecies of Eurasian hoopoe. Some are strongly migratory, especially in the northern parts of their range, while there's also year-round populations. And the strongly migratory subspecies like Epops and Satyrata, they have longer wings than the more sedentary populations since they, you know, go on long migratory flights.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, Tim, that's pretty much all I got on hoopoes.
That was an awesome episode. What a cool bird. And thanks to Seb for the suggestion.
I know, Seb. Yeah, what a great suggestion. And I'll have to do some more European birds in the future, too, so that, you know, I can talk about birds at UC, Seb. Thank you so much. What do you think was your favorite part, Tim?
I think I really enjoyed just learning about all the unique, you know, things that gland provides. It's just that's something that I never expected for a smaller bird like this to just have something that serves so many functions. And it's just awesome.
I know, just a magic little gland.
Yeah.
I like the fact that they're related to hornbills, because, I mean, hornbills are pretty crazy with those giant toucan-like bills and everything.
Yeah, so, yeah, that's really cool, too.
Yeah, I always think it's awesome learning, you know, what birds are related to, because, like, sometimes their close ancestors look really different.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's it for this episode. People, leave reviews. You know, write me with your suggestions. You know, get some of those free stickers. And as always, stay dirty, my birdies.
Birds, birds, birds. Bird, bird, birds.
Dirty Bird Podcast is brought to you by me, John, with my rotating panel of guests and co-hosts. Thanks for being on the show, everybody. The Dirty Bird theme song is by Ricky Pistone. Check out his groovy and hilarious music videos on YouTube. The outro music you're listening to right now is a song New York Redneck by the Sidewalk Slammers. Check them out wherever you get your music. The Dirty Bird Podcast logo is by the very talented TJ Ranosky. And of course, a shout out to my beautiful wife, Lauren, who created my original logo. Check out the show notes for this episode for a full list of credits for any bird calls or sounds used in the episode. Thanks for listening.
Cowboy hats, my drink, my Henny in a wine glass, stepped a